You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moment.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Rita McGrath. Rita is a best-selling author, a sought-after speaker, and longtime professor at Columbia Business School. She's considered one of the world's top experts on innovation and growth. Her work regularly appears in the Harvard Business Review. She is consistently ranked among the top 10 management thinkers in the world and was ranked number one for strategy by Thinkers 50. She has a new book. It's called Seeing Around Corners, How to Spot Inflection Points in Business Before They Happen. Rita McGrath, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I love that in the introduction of your book, you use one of the great lines in literature to illustrate the idea of inflection points, quoting the character Mike Campbell in Hemingway's The Sun Also Rises, who is asked how he went bankrupt. Gradually, he says, then suddenly.
Indeed.
This is perfect, but I want you to, why does that perfectly illustrate these inflection points?
Well, the idea for the book really crystallized when a colleague sent me an article called something like When You Change the World and Nobody Notices. And he talked about the advent of manned flight and how it took months and even years for anybody to really recognize in the mainstream how significant an accomplishment that was. And it got me thinking about the flow of an inflection point and realizing that the early signals that this is about to happen are often quite widespread and quite evident if you're paying attention. And that really was where the thought for the book came, which is a lot of these things build up very gradually over time, and then they go whoosh suddenly as though it had happened overnight. But it doesn't. It happens gradually.
We've talked to a number of artists and scholars and business people who have each used their own language to talk about finding inspirations, often at the edges of their network, and that true innovation is almost never linear nor easily discovered. And your first chapter talks about this, and you use this quote, and I think it's from Andy Grove, right? Snow melts from the edges?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So talk to us about what that means. Why are we finding this on the edge as opposed to, say, in the middle?
Well, most inflection points get going where the existing parameters of the way things are sort of a little weaker. So farther away from the center, farther away from the centrifugal pull of everything that is, which sort of opens things up and allows them to change a little bit. So that's one reason you find these changes starting at the edges. The other reason that you find them starting at the edges is they're often following a different trajectory than your mainstream or core business. So just as an example, if you're in consumer packaged goods today, there are a lot of assumptions you've inherited from the past. So just as an example, nobody would buy a mattress without trying it out first,
yeah.
Right? Well, along comes this company, Casper, coming out of nowhere, right? And many, many others. There are about 150 of them now that sell mattresses direct over the internet. And, you know, you buy it, it comes in a box, you undo the box, you sleep on it for 100 days, and if you don't like it at that point, you send it back. You know, though, who would have thought that in the traditional perspective on that particular sector? And so that's why you really have to get out to the edges of what you think you know to understand the implications of what might be happening.
So I wrote a book and it came out, you know, almost a year after I wrote it. So I imagine you wrote this book, what, a year and a half ago or so?
Oh, easily, yeah.
Easily, right. And one of the major inflection points you talk about in terms of a contemporary business is Facebook. So this must feel somewhat prescient and good timing on your part.
When I first wrote about Facebook and submitted the chapter to my editor, he reacted with complete shock. He said, "Are you telling me you think Facebook's going to have problems?" Yes, I am.
Yeah, and you were very, very, very right. Very right. You in this chapter, you say, quote, "Most of us would be stunned to discover the amount of personally identifiable information about many of our most intimate behaviors that is freely available to anyone with the budget to buy it." That is ominous and true, right?
It is true. It is absolutely true.
What do they know about us? What are they? What kind of things are people discovering?
Oh, they know everything. I mean,
oh, no. Oh,
where
no.
You're going. Mm-hmm. You know, if you combine Facebook's data, and this is the thing that makes it particularly insidious, which is we're used to, in an analog world, having information about ourselves safely tucked away in separate files, right? So mm-hmm. Your doctor's file doesn't overlap with the file from the guy at the bar that you go to, with the auto repair file, with the, you know, kids' hobbies files, right? But once you digitize these things, you can start to combine these files in ways that really reveal a shockingly detailed picture of every single thing you do. So if you combine location data from your phone with credit card payment data, with data about interests, with pictures that you've taken, which show everybody where you are and who you're with, and. So, you know, if you really wanted to dig up some dirt on somebody, it would be remarkably easy to do so.
And like, there's health and wellness apps too, right? So you could have like all your medical information out there.
Oh, absolutely. There are apps that literally send, you know, data that women put in about really sensitive things like your period and how you're feeling and, you know, various kinds of symptoms, and they freely sell them to, you know, pain medication manufacturers and so forth. And I think what bothers me, well, there's a lot that bothers me, but one of the things that really bothers me is how so much of this crucially private information is basically being bartered for completely trivial nonsense.
So Facebook is in the news for a lot right now for many reasons, but the topic du jour is around political ads and people, you know, essentially lying. I found an even more insidious moment in reading your book with regard to Facebook allowing advertisers of housing to prevent ads from being shown to, say, African Americans, Asian Americans. I mean, this is just racist, right?
Well, it's illegal. Not only is it racist, it's illegal.
Racist and illegal.
It violates the Fair Housing Standards Act of 1968. No, I mean, this was a practice that was called out in the analog world by many civil rights activists who said, look, you know, the people from classes who are discriminated against aren't even allowed the basic information of what's available. And that was voted on, and it was made illegal. So Facebook is essentially abetting illegal discriminatory activity.
Okay, so these are these inflection points. Another one that you point out is their own employees. I mean, you had this letter that was sent by their employees saying to Mark Zuckerberg that they disagree with where the company's going, and a lot of good employees have left, too.
Yes, they have. And you saw another employee protest just recently, within the last couple of days, with respect to their political ads.
Wow.
You're not being stronger in policing falsehoods in political ads.
So this leads to, you know, especially in areas of leadership, you know, how do you identify when you're at these points? And you write in the book, quote, "A very common reason that leaders miss potentially important inflection points is that they are isolated from the people who could tell them what is really going on." And this is a theme that comes up again and again and again on this podcast, is the disconnect between leadership and the business, the actual business they're running, and the people who are running their business and their customers, too.
Yes. Yes. Well, it's very easy. You know, the more senior you get, the more you're likely to believe the PR about yourself.
Mm.
You know, and unfortunately, I mean, it's only human. You know, everybody in the world that's around you is telling you how wonderful you are. And, you know, I have a friend who was made a CEO not too long ago, and I said, so what's it like? He said, oh, it's awesome. You know, my jokes are funnier. My wisdom is more sage, and I think I'm even taller. And so, you know, you can get into this situation where you surround yourself by people who give you nothing but positive reinforcement. And so every idea, you've got the great idea, and every thought that flashes through your head is a brilliant thought. And, you know, if you do hear criticism, people say, oh, well, we know that person's a curmudgeon or an idiot or whatever. And so it's very, very human and very easy to get yourself into believing your own PR, which is extremely dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing about our work in improvisation, which is you are forced constantly to be working out of discomfort because you have no script. You have to kind of invent your situation in front of you. And then that becomes a practice, right? So that, you know, over time, you become more at ease with it. And it really requires you to listen to everything. And you write in the book, quote, creative leaders listen to alarmists. That's an amazing idea I have not seen it. You know, I don't think most leaders are like that.
A lot of them aren't. They write people off. I mean, if I think about the people who raise the alarm, who are persistently ignored, you know, you can think of them, Andy Grove used to say, as helpful Cassandras. And as your listeners may know, Cassandra was an ancient Greek woman who was granted the gift of foresight by the gods, but they simultaneously cursed her by saying, yes, you'll see what can happen, but nobody's going to believe you. So these are people who say, hey, there are issues here, and yet the powers that be ignore them or downplay the advice or don't hear the message. And what I find is interesting is oftentimes those people are the ones that are at the edge. They're close to where the phenomena are unfolding, but they don't tend to be invited into your strategy discussions. Mm-hmm. They're not part of your team that, you know, allocates budget. They're kind of in a technical area often, or they're far away from the center of the action. And so it's very easy to discount what they have to say, even though they may see it more clearly than anybody anywhere else in the organization.
You have a line in the book where you say, quote, unfortunately, facts are often a lagging indicator of what could potentially be important. So what is this disconnect between facts? And maybe we should talk about lagging indicators as well.
Sure. So when you think about a fact, that's something that it is documentable, it has happened, and therefore it tells you something, but it tells you something about what's already happened. It's not telling you about what could be about to happen. So the very fact that it's a fact, mm-hmm. by definition, it's a lagging indicator. So you have lagging indicators that are facts. Then you have current indicators that tell you where you are. So things like net promoter score would be an example. So how well are you doing with employee engagement? How well are you doing with customer engagement? Those tell you where you are. And what I try to get people to think about is what are the leading indicators, the indications of what could be on the way, and where should you be looking for those weak, early warning signals that something might be about to change. And a lot of times those are not facts. You know, they're stories, they're qualitative, they're conjectures. Reasonable people can disagree about what they're telling us. So it's not that the people willfully ignore them. It's a lot of times that, you know, you could reasonably have an argument about whether they were meaningful signals from the future or not. And so I think it's the wise leader who allows kind of enough of these to accumulate that you begin to form a pattern. And the way I would think about this is if you're driving along in a car and you can see for some distance ahead of you, if you want to make a course correction, you can just sort of turn the driving wheel a little bit. But if it suddenly comes upon you, something major in the road that you've got to avoid, all of a sudden now you've got to make a big jerk of the steering wheel. And that's the way in which I think about this.
You know, this podcast talks to a lot of scholars and artists as well. And because I work at the intersection of that. But, you know, when you talked about leading indicators often being told as narratives and stories, I'm like, well, that's the point, right? This is where artists and poets and authors and other people can perhaps give us an expression of a thing that doesn't exist yet as a way to sort of build it for the future, because it's not going to come just in the data.
No. And this is one of my issues, actually, with an awful lot of academic research, much of which is terrific, but a lot of it is really backward-looking.
I want to talk about education. So you write in the book, quote, education was supposed to have been thoroughly disrupted by now. What did you mean by that?
Well, if you go back to the history of people saying the sky is falling with respect to education, you can go back all the way to radio, television, movies, you know, subsequent generations of content production, and everybody said that's going to be the end of education as we know it.
Mm.
And I think the fallacy there is that we treat the content of education as though that is education. And I think this comes to us from the days when all the knowledge in the world was preserved by ancient monks, you know, up in monasteries. And if you wanted to get a hold of some of that knowledge, you had to travel to where the monks were, and they would reveal to you what the scribes were and that kind of thing. And I think we still have that mindset around mm-hmm. education today. But education is not so much dumping content on people as it is helping them make meaning out of what those messages tell you. And from that point of view, I don't think education is in any way going to be disrupted. I think it's much more that it's going to change and morph. So, you know, content right now is so much of a commodity. I mean, you can go on YouTube and get more content than was ever available to any human being ever in their entire lifetimes in about 10 minutes. So there's plenty of content of varying degrees of quality. So I think as educators, we need to step away from thinking of ourselves as transmitters of content to really thinking of ourselves as transmitters of meaning.
Hmm.
You know, what does that content mean? How should we be thinking about it? How might it inform future decisions? Those are really the things that educators need to help people understand. And I think that's where we get all mixed up in the role of content creation and content dissemination with what the meaning that's actually made of that content.
And I thought it was interesting, too, because you talk about the potential in accredited degrees, certifying mm-hmm. skills based on the level of skill rather than the degree itself. And that's something you see in the future as becoming, you know, important part of an education of a person.
Absolutely. If you think about it, we collectively as a society are paying a vast amount of money for people to go into vast amounts of debt so they can get a credential, which basically says something. I mean, it says, oh, you know, you showed up for 4 years and you handed in your assignments and you didn't screw up too badly.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, all that credential is a signal that maybe you know a thing or two. It is not the actual accreditation that you know a thing or two. It doesn't tell you anything about what you actually know. And so I find a lot of employers are just really frustrated with the fact that, you know, they're paying for people with all these expensive degrees, right up through advanced degrees. And still, it's a very mixed bag in terms of what those people are actually able to do on the job. So I find an awful lot of employers are now investing in bespoke idiosyncratic training because whatever they're students are getting in the open market isn't really helping them. I'm also finding a real hunger for less expensive, more focused alternatives. So if I can get a certification that I know how to do, I don't know, Python coding or something, that tells my employer what to expect, and it tells anybody around me what I am worth. So I'm really a big believer in people, especially in that middle tier, middle skill kind of world, to go get a credential that actually tells people what you can do, and then you have much less of a fight about getting through that front door.
So you probably don't know this about Second City, but like our biggest division now is our corporate division, which does training to corporate America. And we're constantly being brought in to teach very skilled people, often in tech areas or accounting, how to talk and listen to other people.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. So it's this.
It's frightening, isn't it?
Well, yeah. So, yeah, on many levels, but though it makes sense. I mean, we have this pedagogy, which is wonderful in terms of what they traditionally call soft skills. And I think what people are discovering, especially in a more tech enabled universe, that the soft skills are maybe the harder skill that, mm-hmm. that these individuals need. And they're not getting it during their 4-year degree or more likely even their MBA, their master's, whatever.
Exactly.
Mm. Okay, healthcare is another area that you note that there's an inflection point. And I think most people know this, but I'll just say it from the book, quote, not only are healthcare costs in the United States higher than in the rest of the world, they've also been rising faster than elsewhere. I mean, this mm-hmm. We had a health issue in my family. It is crazy in terms of these bills that you receive. They don't feel real.
Right, right.
So what's going to happen there?
Well, I think we're having very active debates right now at a policymaking level. And the reality is that we as a society so far have made the decision that we are going to emphasize access to exotic treatments and privately negotiated agreements about what pharmaceutical companies and others and other healthcare providers will be reimbursed without any respect to quality, without any respect to the actual costs, without any respect to the other economic criteria that you would use in a functioning market to make some of those pricing decisions. So healthcare has all these weird kinks to it where, you know, how much you pay depends on who you are, not what the procedure cost.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're covered by private insurance, you're going to pay one price. And if you're not covered by insurance at all, you're going to pay a different price. And it makes no sense. The idea of introducing cost into the discussion is seen by many in the healthcare space in America as anathema. We don't talk about costs. It's like going into a church and talking about the devil or something.
Right.
And yet any other functioning market, and see, this is where I have a big disconnect with it, which is we say, on the one hand, we want the private market to be able to thrive in this environment, and yet so many of the mechanisms that allow any other market to work well are just not existent in healthcare at all. So if you take, for example, just price increases on old drugs, so, you know, one of the arguments pharma companies make about why they should get paid so much is that, oh, you know, we're out there doing God's work. We're inventing R&D, and many of them really are. But you can't tell me a drug that's been around for 40 years and is no longer getting investments in R&D actually merits 7 to 15% price hikes when their people are depending on them. And so there's this element of just uncontrolled rapaciousness, which I think is not good in our healthcare system. And I think what we're starting to see now is pushback. You know, people are saying, hey, why do I have to pay 10 times as much for the exact same drug that I can buy in Canada for, you know, a fraction of the price that we pay here? Why is it that I can be in Denmark and get very exotic cancer treatment for an iota of the price that we would have to pay here? You know, why is it cheaper for me to go to Mexico and get my dental work done than it is here? And so I think those disconnects, they sort of grow over time. And I think the healthcare industry has done a terrific job of making it so confusing and so complicated that a lot of people just throw up their hands and say there's no hope, and it just goes on its merry way. However, in the book, one of the shining examples I talk about is Caterpillar. And this gentleman at Caterpillar, Todd Bisping, basically said, hey, you know, the whole pharmaceutical supply chain is a supply chain operational issue, and I'm going to approach it that way. And so what he did was just very systematically look at each element of ad cost, and this was specifically for prescription drugs. So look, each element of additional cost. And he said, you know, we're the ones paying the bills, and yet we're totally out of, you know, we feel totally out of control. We don't feel we have any influence over this system, even though we're paying for it. And in the book, I really describe how he went systematically, step by step, through the whole way this system has been constructed with pharmaceutical benefits managers and rebates and list prices versus not risk list prices and clawbacks. I mean, the whole thing is just a giant hairball. And they just disentangled it. And as a consequence, Caterpillar's healthcare prescription drug costs have been rising much more slowly than anybody else's, and they're arguably way ahead of others in terms of the quality of care for the price that they have to pay for it.
So that's a story of a company being innovative and going into the weeds and figuring this out. You also tell a story that went the other way, and this is the BBC, and they did this fiasco about the digital media initiative. So I think that's a really great story to tell.
Sure. So what happened was they intuited correctly that the world was going to be more digital, and that if they could manage to get all their content and all the various assets that they have onto some kind of digital platform, that would produce efficiencies, and it would give them a lot more ability to be flexible, and there'd be a lot more to be able to do. And all of that was totally right. What they did, though, was they did a classic thing that I see in IT systems all the time, which is they basically handed over the design of it to a third party, and they used what is commonly called a waterfall method, which means you gather up all the requirements, and then you sort of throw it over the transom to the programming people, and they program stuff, and then they hand it back to the users for testing, and the users go, well, that wasn't what I asked for.
Mm-hmm.
And then all along the way, the whole thing gets more and more expensive because you run into problems you didn't anticipate, and. So they made just about every mistake in the book. And what eventually happened was the actual users of the system really didn't have much input into the system. The contractor that they hired really wasn't supervised. They were often in ice flow doing their own thing. And so you basically had this huge unmanaged mess that eventually the BBC had to look at it and say, look, we cannot put more money into this thing, and we have no value from it because it's incomplete, and so we're just going to shut it down. And that's eventually what they did.
Losing just hundreds of millions of pounds.
Yes, very sadly so. By the way, this is not just to dump on the BBC. I mean, within the last 6 months, we've heard stories of General Electric and many other luminary companies who've put hundreds of millions of dollars into these digital transformation efforts without really thinking it through and knowing what they're doing.
Yeah, you write in the book, quote, perhaps the biggest myth that gets in the way of innovation is that it's all about the big idea.
Right.
And I say this all the time. I mean, people are always coming to me like, I've got a great idea. And I'm like, there are so many great ideas. How do we actually get the idea done in a way that works, which is a very different path?
Yeah, exactly.
You have a term in here that you call innovation theater, and I don't think you mean that in a good way.
No, I don't.
Tell us.
So, you know, what's happened now is as competitive advantages have gotten shorter, as the entry barriers have come down, is, you know, it's on the agenda now, which is good. I mean, it wasn't necessarily the case some years back. I mean, people often would talk about innovation, but not for real. You know, it would be kind of like, oh, yeah, right, innovation. So now what we've got is people have this pressure to say, yes, we're doing something about innovation. So what do? They put everybody in a plane and send them off to Silicon Valley. And, they ride around on the Google bikes and they have coffee in Palo Alto and they listen to all the entrepreneurs talking about their business models. And this is all great. And then they get back on the plane and they come back to, you know, Dubuque or Peoria or Tennessee or wherever they're from. And that was great. But now what do we do with that? Right. And so I'm not saying it's bad to do that. What I'm saying is it's not a great investment if you have no plan to follow up. So if you really want to do innovation, it has at least three major practices to go with it. So the first is the practice indeed for getting good ideas. So how do you ideate and capture those ideas so that they're meaningful in some way? Then how do you incubate? How do you go from having a raw idea to having something you might actually be able to show a customer or to prototype or to introduce to a market? And then you've got this very interesting next step, which is if this innovation is really going to make a difference to the future of your company, you have to be able to accelerate it. And what I mean by acceleration is you have to get this thing up to industrial grade. So all those lawyers you've been avoiding for the last, you know, 2 years, now all of a sudden they've got to have a seat at the table and compliance has to be invited in. And guess what? Your IT infrastructure needs to get industrialized. And so there's all this kind of growing up that has to happen in the context of your new ventures. And I think a lot of times that takes organizations by surprise because, you know, it's fun and cool to say, oh, here's our little innovation group and they're going to work around the clock and they're going to produce these great things. But if it's really going to make a difference to your company, it's got to become a corporate grown-up. And guess what? It's got to look a lot more like a corporate grown-up by the time it does that.
And you outline, you have a thing, the innovation proficiency scale. So, you know, anyone can kind of read this and sort of take their guess where their company is at. So I did this. My office is now conveniently situated one office away from the president of our company. And I was reading this chapter. So I went, Steve, look at what these different levels and identify for me which level you think we're at. And I had already known what I thought. So we both agreed that Second City is at level 4, which is opportunistic innovation, I believe. And we're really good at incubating because that's what improv is, right? It's the rapid prototyping of creativity. So we have groups of people who know how to make something out of nothing. We prototype that in front of audiences over and over and over again. But the reason we don't go up to level 5, when I looked at this, is because we have no budget set aside across the organization for innovation-related activities. It is core in our core product of putting up theatrical shows and in some of our, like, the projects that we get when we're working in corporate space or elsewhere, but not across the company as a broader concern. So I'm wondering, like, what is it? So what is it? It's got to be more than just having the money to do that. You've got to have sort of the institutional will, I would imagine.
Well, what it is really is there the pressure, the pull pressure for innovation? You know, we a lot of times, when especially in this world of innovation theater, we think about the push. So how many great ideas did we come up with and how much stuff did we do? But nobody's really saying, you know, show me all the things you incubated and show me where they went. And let's talk about all the learning that you've done. And let's talk about what investments you made that maybe didn't pan out in a commercial sense, but maybe led to some really interesting options for the future. And so nobody really measures or assesses those pull measures for innovation. So, you know, kind of what would the output look like? So together with that is, and I couldn't comment on what you guys do, but for a lot of companies, let's say I work in supply chain, and I've got a great idea for how we could really make this one process so much more user-friendly for a customer. Where do I go with that? Who do I even talk to about it? You know, a lot of times what will end up happening is, you know, you'll talk about it to your buddies at the water cooler, or you mention it to somebody over lunch, but there's no way for that idea to find its way to someone who could do something about it at a systemic level. And that's what I mean when I'm getting at that centralized budget for innovation-related things, so that if I have a good idea, no matter where I am in the company, there's some way of getting a small amount of resource to test, to learn, to, you know, bring other people that should know into the system, into the process.
So interesting. I want you to talk, I'm going to ask you in a second for your yes and story, which is how we always end the podcast. But before we do that, late in the book, you have a really interesting chapter around women in terms of leading. And you cite Sally Helgeson, am I saying her name right, her study?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was very interesting where women were, quote, focused on the doing of various tasks rather than on their completion, and that they also created webs of inclusion. We've had a number of people on the show to talk about women leaders as opposed to men leaders, and just so you know, we sort of follow the category of being better. We like the women leadership model better than the men leadership model, at least the people I've talked to. So talk to us about her research and how you wrote about it in the book.
Sure. So one of the things that I think is a big shift in how we're thinking about leadership is as the world becomes more uncertain and as it moves more quickly, we're becoming pretty keenly aware that one person cannot be all-seeing and all-knowing. And we're also becoming very aware that the farther sort of up the organization you go, the more knowledge you just don't have. You know, back to that theme of, you're being surrounded by people who tell you what you want to hear. So one of the things that we find about women as leaders is they tend to be much more comfortable with less hierarchical, flatter, more collaborative engagements with the people they lead. So much more comfortable, you know, letting other people take the credit, for example, much more comfortable letting people weigh in on what they're really good at and not sort of insisting that everybody be the same cookie cutter mold, which is where this webs of inclusion comes from. Women, and I can't comment on whether this is neuroscience or whether this is socialization, but women tend to be better at getting diverse talents to be able to work together than pushing everybody into all behaving a certain way. And so this new style of leadership is able to, you know, you keep decision rights. And I think this is where we get confused. We're like, oh, well, people are just being a pushover. That's not it. You keep your decision rights. You have the ultimate authority. But where you're getting your information, how you're getting your information is much broader, much more inclusive, and much more likely to be a little off the beaten track than for many men leaders. And so one of the premier women leaders, you know, that gets talked about a lot is the former CEO of the Girl Scouts, who was really recognized as just a superlative motivator, mobilizer of other people. Some of my current heroes who happen to be women who are leaders, Nancy McKinstry at Wolters Kluwer, multi-billion-dollar complete digital transformation that nobody ever talks about. It's astonishing. You know, she took that company from about 15% digital revenue to now they're almost, I think they're like 90% digital revenue in a 10-year period, which is just warp speed for a large incumbent publishing house, basically, is what they were. And so that's an example. Another one that I love and I cite in the book is Sharon John, who's the CEO of Build-A-Bear Workshop. And I was just recently, in fact, at a book event in New York, and she and I were joking about one of her simple mantras for leadership, which is, you know, stop doing stupid stuff.
That's a good one.
You know, it's like, and then once you've stopped doing stupid stuff, start doing smart stuff. I mean, it sounds so simple, but when you really take a step backward and you say, why am I doing this again? In any organization, there's stupid stuff that creeps in. So I think the simple phrases like that that are very inclusive, that get people to feel that they can make a difference. And that's the kind of leadership I think we're all really hungry for.
Well, yeah, because I mean, I think we tend to hire based on confidence rather than competence, and what our idea of confidence is, which is like from a TV show from the 50s about a man. I mean, it doesn't make any sense, and it's never been true, and it's certainly based on the sort of, you know, sexist, racist world that a lot of us grew up in, and it's changing, I think, but I don't know how quickly.
Well, and I think that's another place where, you know, and I run a program called Women in Leadership up at Columbia, mm-hmm. which is, that's another whole story. We should have another podcast just on that.
So
part of what you find in that program is, you know, we all talk about having self-awareness and emotional intelligence and how that's super important for leadership, and everybody nods and says, yeah, well, you know, a lot of the women, because they have a fair amount of self-awareness and emotional intelligence, they're very keenly aware of the things that they're perhaps not good at. And they're much more willing to sort of hold themselves back as a function of that. So the typical thing that gets talked about is, you know, your average male will sort of say, out of 10 requirements for a job, if they've got two of them, they're like, oh, I've got that, I'll go for it. You know, mm-hmm. And women are much more likely to say, well, oh, gee, I've only got 9. Now, do you think I can manage that last one? And, you know, it's hilarious when you see how women kind of present themselves. And yet, because we, as you said, judge leadership potential a lot of times on the basis of confidence, many times of which is completely misplaced, we tend mm-hmm. to give the nod to these people that sort of tell us they can do it without any evidence supporting that point.
A little thing called the Dunning-Kruger effect, perhaps. That comes up again and again and again. All right. Mm-hmm. So we always end the podcast asking our guest for a yes and story. So the idea here is that when groups of people are making something out of nothing, their default setting is usually to say no or to do nothing. And in improv, we know that. So we say, nope, you got to say yes and. You can't just start at yes. You have to say yes and. And I'm wondering if there's a moment in your life, and it could be work or at home or wherever, where you were inclined to say no, but instead you took the leap to yes and.
Oh, many, many of them. Let me just think. Probably one of the best was when I got to a plateau with the previous life I'd had, which was running IT systems for government agencies. I know, very sexy. but I got to a plateau with that, and my husband and I were thinking about what would the next thing be. And I had a really good friend who was doing her PhD at NYU at the time. And we started to explore, well, would a PhD program be at all of interest? And my initial response was, well, you know, interesting, but not really. I don't want to take a vow of poverty and just spend 4 years in a PhD program kind of being on ice, you know, without really progressing in my career. And I had a lot of reasons why I could have talked myself out of it. And then we got to thinking about it. We said, well, you know, you love communicating and teaching. You've always been fascinated by business. We can swing it financially by our fingernails, you know, maybe. And wouldn't that open up a whole lot of new and interesting opportunities that you just don't know what they are yet? And that turned out to be a real moment of yes and for me.
Oh, that's great. The book is called Seeing Around Corners, How to Spot Inflection Points in Business Before They Happen. Rita McGrath, thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is L.F. Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com. Feel young. Each week, every secret.
survives.
Survive.